I hear the train a-comin', it's rolling round the bend. I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison. Time keeps dragging on. And I hear that whistle blowing way down to San Antone.
Classic Cash.
I love Johnny.
Classic.
The man in black.
Charles, thank you so much, man.
Hi. Thanks for having me, man.
It's great to meet. I know we chatted on the phone, and and I got to thank Martin for setting this up. And yeah, I guess all you engineers kind of hang out with each other? Or?
Martin and I worked together from 1984 till the early 90s.
Okay.
And we were also neighbors in Newmarket, Ontario.
That's interesting.
And we kept in touch over the years, and he sort of left Newmarket and went to live in the Kitchener-Waterloo area and then started up another company and now has sold that, and now he's into green engineering and
he's doing a
watching
bunch of
the
stuff.
Carbon footprint, and he's got something like 12 patents. Just an amazing story.
Yeah. Anyway, it was good to have him on the show, and I always like having you guys, your engineers, on the show. Mm-hmm. On today's show, we're going to dive, I guess, into the Union Station project that worked on.
That's one of them. That was part of it. Maybe one of my signature projects in my career. So it was kind of a nice one to share.
Nice.
Let me
share your information. So Charles Kranz is here, Geostructural Project Services. You can reach him at cgkranz@outlook.com. Website? Yeah, there's a website. www. Nope. I thought I saw it on the doc. No?
Nope, no website.
Okay. You're old school.
The clients find me.
That's all it is, huh? I want to do a quick shout out to Gary Mayers, Mayers Carpentry. I'm wearing his tee today. I always wear a different tradesperson's tee. Just give him a shout out. High-Tech Concrete Cutting is a leading provider for all concrete scanning, x-ray, cutting, and coring throughout Ontario. They pride themselves in providing highest quality service in a safe manner, on time, and on budget. With the background, knowledge, and support of more than 30 years experience from the owner Dan St. Ange, there is no job that they cannot quote or complete. Their fleet is equipped with top-of-the-line trucks and equipment, which eliminates any uncertainty for downtime and allows our highly skilled crews to complete your project without delays. Choose High-Tech Concrete Cutting for your next project and see the difference when dealing with the industry leaders. Find them at www.hightechcutting.ca and on Instagram at hightechconcretecutting. Do you dread the office? Are you spending your personal time on paperwork? Join the club. The good news is there's a solution that isn't hard or overwhelming. With SyncedUp's estimating and job tracking software, you can plan for it and hit your profit goals all while cutting your estimating time by up to 90%. Do you know where your money is going? Are you sure you're even making money? SyncedUp will show you exactly where your money is going with its simple budgeting tool, revealing those cash leaks so you can take back control of your business. Do you wonder if all those payroll hours are making you money or costing you money? SyncedUp tracks your unbillable labor, helping you optimize for project efficiency and ensuring each job is profitable. At SyncedUp, they're here to help contractors thrive, not just survive. Get a budgeting consultation with a SyncedUp expert looking over your shoulder to help you optimize your company's budget for free using the link in the show notes. If you love what you see, you can use the TCL discount and get 20% off on your first 6 months. Annual plan is required. Just click on the link in the show notes to book your call with the sales team and mention the TCL podcast. Check out SyncedUp.com and at SyncedUp on IG to level up your business. Hey, architects and builders, do you want to stand out from the competition? Fraser Wood Siding has your back. Fraser Wood Siding is a leader in pre-finished wood siding. They manufacture beautiful pre-finished wood siding using only the highest quality PEFC certified Canadian softwood. Fraser Wood Siding is available in 17 profiles and unlimited colors, supplied by the global leader in paints, Sherwin-Williams. Whether your design taste is classic, contemporary, conservative, or bold, they've got you covered. They'll gladly match the color of any paint manufacturer and send a sample on an actual piece of Fraser Wood Siding in just a few days. Visit their website at www.fraserwoodsiding.com and reach out about your upcoming projects to benefit from their industry-leading lead times. Fraser Wood Siding, get inspired. Looking for cutting-edge solutions for your spray foam needs? Look no further than Elastichem Specialty Chemicals. With a remarkable track record spanning over three decades, Elastichem stands as an industry-leading supplying contractors across Canada with top-grade closed-cell, open-cell, and specialty foam products and accessories. Experience hassle-free spraying in both summer and winter with Insulthane Extreme, Canada's groundbreaking HFO closed-cell product. Time is precious, and we know it. Optimize your efficiency and avoid downtime by choosing the best products with the best technical and customer support. Elevate your spray foam game today with Insulthane Spray Foam products by Elastichem. Give them a try today. Visit their website at www.elastichem.com or give them a call at 1-877-787-2436. Time to sign up for Phil, the free construction marketplace and load tracking app for developers, engineers, and all contractors working in the civil construction industry. One other thing to mention is business and facility listings. Phil has the most complete database of quarries, pits, plants, and depots in Ontario, including all of the big names. So if you're looking for concrete, stone, asphalt, whatever, you'll be able to find it. You can also add your business listing or claim it. It might already be on the map. Sign up for free on the website at www.getphil.app. That's www.getphil.app. You can also search Phil in the App Store. Construction pros, brace yourselves for a revolutionary experience. HTGNA, your ultimate destination for state-of-the-art concrete floor preparation equipment, is about to change the game. Our model, surface preparation, is not just a task, it's our expertise, and your satisfaction is a guarantee. HTGNA isn't your average, it's a commitment. Our line of concrete floor preparation equipment stands tall as the epitome of industry excellence. Ready to take your projects to the next level? Dive into htgnorthamerica.com for a glimpse of innovation. Lock in a demo now and immerse yourself in the HTGNA experience. HTG North America, surface preparation equipment is our expertise, your satisfaction, our guarantee. Where do you want to begin, Charles?
I thought I would give a shout out of my own too.
Totally.
So I've been a project manager and engineer in heavy civil construction my whole career. And the thing I learned,
how many years are we talking about? How many decades?
I'm in my 43rd year.
Wow.
Of full-time work. And I worked as a surveyor for 3 summers before that to put myself through university. I came to learn over the years that, you can't get it done without the guys out on the job. Totally. Working hard and doing that, and I don't think they get enough credit.
No. Nope.
And as to all you young project managers sitting in your office, get out to the sites, go talk to the men, see where they're at. Sometimes they'll have better ideas of how to do things than you might have had. And learn their names, learn about their families, and have a conversation, maybe have a coffee break with the guys. Just, you know, a strong field crew can make a weak project manager look good. But a strong project manager can never look good if he's got weak field crews.
No.
So I'm full of respect for the guys out there getting it done.
Yeah, I totally agree. Are we seeing, I know that there's some stigmas attached to the young engineers out there, and they don't want to get on site as often as, I guess, you guys are used to.
That's so wrong. That's so wrong.
But that is kind of like the norm. That's what we see, right? Everything's want to be done over the phone or over a call.
The engineers I'm mentoring, and at this stage of my career, I'm doing a lot of mentoring.
Nice.
I encourage that on-site presence. That's when you learn what's going on. And I'm lucky I've got some very good clients who basically support that theory, that kind of motivation.
Well, there's drive behind the footprint on the job site. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? The moment you arrive there, you see what's happening regarding the crew, you see what's unfolding, and then you also see possibilities of trying maybe other things that could work really well. I've seen that before. I've been on sites before, and I've seen the engineer show up, have a conversation, and they're right in the pit. They're right on the gravel. They're right talking with the crew, and they're trying to figure out how do we, and they have the drawings right there. And they're like, let's talk about this. Let's figure this out.
Well, I learned among the many things I've learned, one was be available to your field people that are supporting you. When they call and they got a question, answer the phone. And if you can't deal with it right away, commit to when you can come and help them out. I had a client, for example, and he would call me every so often. We were doing a large waterfront project in Toronto. And he'd say, you've got to start giving this project more attention. I'd say, tell you what, I'll meet you for coffee tomorrow at 7:30 on site and let's take a walk and see what's going on. I went to the site. Everything was going fine. No problems at all. He just wanted company.
Sometimes he just needs an extra pair of eyes on the site. That's all it is.
That's managing clients.
Yeah, that's part of the industry, part of the options in your work. Yeah. That's it.
So the project we're seeing on the screen, I spent a ton of time at that site.
What was the, when did that happen? What years are we talking about here?
We were awarded the work in 2010. We started late 2010, and our base contract wrapped up the following year, but then we were doing such a good job, the construction manager kept on giving us more scope. We started out, I think, with a $2.2 million contract, and at the end of it, I looked, my billings were at $6.6 million for the work we did on that job.
Kept on growing?
Just grew.
So how old is the Union Station? Like, I know that it's the busiest station in Canada.
Well, if we go to a couple of the slides, I can probably give you a bit of the background on that.
Sure.
So...
So everyone that's not from Toronto, I guess Union Station is on Front Street there. It's been transformed quite a bit. There's more work going on it right now, I think.
The second phase of the work that we started in 2011 wrapped up just fairly recently. And there's now some additional work going on back in the back of the train shed to establish more pasture concourses. Because anyone who's come into their rush hour, those stairways and escalators down from the platform can get pretty congested.
Yeah.
And they're just trying to ease that because there's growth. They're expanding GO service and that station's getting busier and busier.
Is it just expanding the services or are we concerned with any key structural components to this structure?
This is a very sound structure.
That's what I assumed.
So the front portion was built, I think, in early 1900s.
Okay.
The rear viaduct, what we call the viaduct, which is basically an underground structure below the tracks, was built in the 1920s. And that was the area where our main focus of work was. We basically created a second basement below the train tracks while keeping the trains above in service, supporting these massive 3-foot diameter columns inside and excavating down. We went down in some places about 6 meters, say 20 feet, and created a whole new sub-basement structure. And that's now shopping concourse. It's retail. It's waiting areas for the trains. It's all of the above.
Yeah, someone told me yesterday or the day before that path, so the walkways around Toronto, all the underground walkways, it's actually the largest infrastructure walkway in North America.
Yes.
Which is crazy. So it's just, but I also know that Union Station is still on sound ground, or is it part of that ground that was added to the city?
The back portion of the station, the viaduct, was on reclaimed land. Front Street used to be the waterfront. That's why they call it Front Street.
Yeah, okay.
So yes, what you see there is the Front Street facade, and that is... It was on the original shoreline.
Yeah.
But in the course of excavating inside, we found all manner of different things. Like people dumped things in the harbor, let's say, and we unearthed them in excavating out to create this new sub-basement.
Yeah.
Actually, on a site about 2 blocks from here, we actually found a case of muskets underground. Someone had probably been dropped off a ship that was docked there.
Yeah, that's right, because it would have been right there at Front Street. Yeah.
And of course, the archaeologists poured into the site and shut us down so they could look for more stuff.
They collected it? Did they reclaim them? Or
I don't know if they got anything else. We used to find ceramic jars and things like that. But the case of muskets was the real highlight.
So is it fair to say that what you guys are tackling, like this whole deep boring, like the micropiles and everything, and just getting lower and lower and lower, is it because the structures are getting more complex that they need to take this foundation stronger? Or is it because the actual soil conditions?
Well, no, the foundations for the viaduct were very sound. They were down to rock.
Okay.
But we had to basically uncover these very rough square concrete piers that were probably about 5 or 6 feet square.
Okay.
And underpin them and then break out this rough square element and extend the nice round column down to a new foundation.
How did you underpin a square 5x5? Did it have to jet out?
No, we used micropiles in the corners and a framework to support everything above. And that may be in one of the slides that we see here.
I might be able to illustrate. We can flip through here. You want to advance to the next one?
Let's go.
So obviously anybody who's listening, you'd be better off watching because we're going to go through a lot of images here.
Right. This is a designated National Historic Site. And it had to remain in full service during the dig down.
What's the material of the actual structure? So is it limestone? The pillars in the front there?
They're all concrete.
It's all concrete?
Concrete, yes. Yeah. They had concrete then.
Okay. It looks like limestone. I guess it's just from the aging.
Yeah. So
I know a lot of trades that have been on the show before, they've actually worked on them. They worked on parts of these, of the Union Station renovations, and they actually had a blast working on them because of the challenges.
Well, the logistical challenge to this job, there was only one way into the site for all the trades, and you've been in enough sites to know when you have 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 trades going,
it's just congestion.
They're getting shipments. Yeah. They're sending stuff away. Like just removing the excavated soil from this site was a major challenge.
Wow.
We started out by trying to use poured ready mix concrete, and pumping it through concrete pumps through lines into the work area. And at the end of it, we found that it was, even though it was quite expensive to buy concrete this way, you buy pre-mixed pallets of pre-mixed bags and mix them on site. We found that that was even more efficient because then we didn't have to try and wait for a truck. We just mixed what we needed when we needed. And
as long as you got the material in there.
Well, yeah, you had to schedule that. And there was a lot
during
of night.
During the evening
night,
hours or
night
something?
Hours.
Yeah,
and things
okay,
like. Yes,
that's
yes.
What I figured.
Yeah, so we'll go on and... I want to show people some pictures.
Okay. We can keep on going through. Yeah. Okay. So you want to get through. I know that I saw some diagrams there, right? So you had the viaduct and then the roadway. So you want to keep on advancing.
You see that last bullet point, access via a single truck door.
Single, huh? Wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So this is the key plan of the site. So you can see what was the original GO Transit concourse over on the Bay Street side.
Yep.
And the headworks area, that's the main station itself, the main hall and offices. So our scope was basically everything in blue and green that you see there.
Oh, and that's a big job, eh?
Yeah,
it took 10 plus years? 11.
They finally finished building the new concourse at near the York Street side, I'd say somewhere around 2015. It was quite...
I'll be honest, it's been a while since I've been there.
Yep.
Been inside there.
It's quite
something
now.
I should check it out.
Now.
Yeah.
Okay, so that gives people the picture. We had to bid to our own design for supporting these excavations. So we were thinking of different ways to do this. Like you can get low headroom drilling equipment. And so what we do when we construct an excavation support system, we have to install vertical steel elements piles.
Yep.
And then we put facing between the piles and we anchor them back, and that creates a vertical wall.
You're creating shoring.
Shoring. It's
shoring
basically shoring.
Above.
Shoring in low headroom.
In low headroom. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So we thought of the idea of getting the concrete in there and taking the spoil out from the auger process, which is, creates, some fairly significant volumes. And I had come back a few years prior from working in the U.S. where I learned about micropiles, which were just in their infancy back then. These were small diameter elements.
How small the diameter are we talking about?
Ranging from 5-inch diameter to about 12 3/4 inches, considered a micropile.
Okay.
And it's steel casing, and you flush it out inside. You may socket it into bedrock or into competent soil, and you put central reinforcing in it, and then cement grout, and that creates this structural element, steel and concrete.
Yeah.
So... but we said, we're going to use these for shoring piles. And that had never been done in Toronto. So,
it had ever been done in Canada?
I don't know about the other markets, but for sure it hadn't been done in the Ontario Toronto market, which is the biggest market in the country.
Not until 2010?
No.
Wow. All right. So
this took away the problem of getting ready-mix concrete in there and getting a lot of drilling spoil, which is the cuttings we create out.
Yeah.
Because we were able to basically put our cuttings into bins and take the bins out at night. And there was much less volume of material, so it was pretty innovative.
Okay.
We actually were able to get some research grants for some of the technologies we developed there.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, so gear on.
Next. Yeah.
Okay, this is a little bit of stuff about micropiles.
So a lot of the micropile and the shotcrete.
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So basically what you were just talking about, the zero cleanse, and here you go, right? So this is what you guys had to work with.
Here's the cross-section.
Yeah.
So that you can see... the existing floor, actually someone wrote exiting floor, but it's existing.
and new guy.
You see a bit of a soil profile on the right, sand and silt clay fill, and then sand and silt, and then shale bedrock.
Yep.
So we created the shotcrete facing, the micropile, and the rock anchor. And those are some of those unreinforced concrete piers I was speaking of that supported the original viaduct.
So when you're saying unreinforced, what do you mean by that?
No steel in it.
Just pure concrete.
Just pure concrete.
Does that not make it stronger or weaker?
No, the reinforcing, concrete is very weak in tension. It's very strong in compression,
okay,
like pushing on it, but very weak in tension. So the idea behind reinforcing is that it prevents cracking and deterioration of of the element. But these were buried in the ground. They never saw the light of day until we exposed them. So
the pressure from the soil would actually assist it.
Yes.
So the pressure of the soil is actually compensating for the lack of steel.
Yes. But once we exposed them and now they were going to be freestanding, we had to, some of them we kept and they were jacketed with carbon fiber and mesh to basically pull everything together. And others, we did the underpinning I explained earlier and put in a brand new column.
I've seen that. That's getting done quite a bit now where they're actually covering up the concrete to reinforce it with the carbon fiber material, right? Right.
So the original headroom for this work, it was a three-part job. The bay side, we had headroom of about 16 feet to work in, and we had equipment that could easily work in that headroom.
Okay.
And on the York side, we had similar. But in the middle, under the old Via Concourse in the center, we only had about 8 feet of headroom to work in. And we'll see some pictures later on of working in that low headroom.
Right, so and then all the while that you're working, you got trains coming over every second, all kinds. Of
trains, yep.
Yeah.
Yep. These are just some details. You see the round pile. We see the shotcrete facing. Shotcrete is concrete that's applied by spraying out of a nozzle.
Yeah.
And that was
what's
how
the PSI on shotcrete?
Similar to regular concrete, it can be anywhere from 3,000 to 6,000.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. So carry on. There's a couple of details of some lateral support to the existing footings.
How many did you end up putting on the angle piles?
The anchors?
Yeah,
the anchors. We did probably several hundred anchors, but we did about 40 permanent anchors that
how
are
long
still in
service.
How long
were they going down?
Well, if you go back a couple slides, back again one more that. Okay, so you see we're at elevation 76 at the pier and the rock is down at around 71.
Yep.
So that's 5 meters vertically times 1.4 is about 8 meters plus the socket in the rock, which is another 4 or 5 meters. So these are say 12 meters long, 40 feet.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh yeah, okay. There'll be some in a few slides from here. We'll see the anchor, the drill actually drilling them.
Okay, let's carry go on. Forward. There, so right here.
So there we're doing some vertical micropiles in the low headroom area I told you about in the vehicle.
That's about 8 feet there.
Yes.
Okay.
So
all the machinery is still internal combustion engines, or are we?
We have a combination. The one you just saw does have a diesel engine, and so did the one we're looking at now.
Okay.
But that firm that was my employer at the time does have some. Hydraulically powered equipment, as well as ones that are electric, and the power pack is a combustion engine, but it can be located outside of the building.
Yep.
And umbilical cords go into the
actual pool itself. I've heard of that.
Which creates a much better environment for people to work in.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so you can see some of the.
So those are the 40-meter anchors that are going in.
Not 40 foot.
Oh, sorry, 40 foot. Yeah, 40.
And
foot.
You see some of those 3 foot columns, and right above those are the tracks.
Wow. And that's about 16 feet there.
That's about 16 feet of headroom in there, yes.
How many men are we? How many tradespeople are in there? Like how many?
Oh, at the height of, well, we had the excavation and demolition guys and ourselves. And they were relocating mechanical, electrical. There was a little bit of that going on. And then the concrete work didn't really start till we were almost done.
In other words,
but then structural steel had to be brought in. Just an amazing number of different things were going on at the same time.
How much, I'm like curious, Charles, how much homework do you have to do before you begin? Because you're dealing with a structure that you guys can't see through things. You have to do a lot of discovery, no?
We had the existing drawings, and we had some knowledge of the local soils conditions already. So we had a pretty good idea what we were going to be up against that way. They did do soil borings before the job started,
okay.
So of course we had those to examine. And of course, we had to produce our own drawings and retained a firm that produced our engineering drawings for this work is actually one of my clients now.
Okay.
And they did excellent work on the drawings. And once the drawings are in hand, then we get started on site. And of course, things go wrong, things are different, and that's when I get a phone call and I got to get down there.
Because you could start opening things up and you could start drilling and you could start discovering things.
As we started working, then we started learning more.
Mm.
Okay. So,
anyway, so. And I mean, I'm assuming that the workers that are there working, this is not their first canoe trip. You know, I mean, you've got a crew there that's been doing this type of work for quite a bit of time, right?
Well, I had a full-time field engineer the gentleman who co-authored the paper with me, his, in the credits, Naresh, and head foreman and several sub foremen, then our drillers and our helpers and our laborers. We probably had 8 or 9 guys at any one time, and we had multiple rigs going in some areas once once things opened up a little bit. So,
pretty
carry on.
Yep.
Okay, so there's some shotcrete. We've done one lift, and the mesh is there for the next lift below. And you can see the vertical round piles that we installed previously.
Yep, I see that.
And those angled ones, those are the temporary anchors. They're
how thick are you doing the shotcrete?
The target was 4 inches, 100 millimeters.
Okay, all right.
Okay, and there we are in the near the York Street area applying shotcrete. And we found an obstacle, which is one of those piers that was abandoned. And they just said, well, work around it. Just work around it.
Okay.
So, that's an example. So this was interesting. This is an area where we had to put in some temporary excavation support. So instead of using shotcrete, we used timber. They call it lagging.
Yep.
And you see that steel superstructure in there.
Yeah.
The blue route was the way from the original Bay Street Concourse into Air Canada Centre.
Okay.
They call it the Blue Route because of the Maple Leafs. So yep. That was how people got off the trains and got into the
arena.
Right
to the arena.
And we were right smack in the middle of that. So we had to create a temporary Blue Route, which is basically we created that overhead walkway, enclosed it and drywalled it so people would be walking to Air Canada Centre not knowing that underneath them there was this.
All that work was going on.
Absolutely.
They had no idea.
Nope. Well, you might have heard some noise. And we had some posters on the walls of the Blue Route explaining what was going on. So if you had time, you could stop and look at the posters and understand what was happening.
So that's pretty neat.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was, I call it Blue Route. Okay.
So actually, sorry, can you go back to that other page? So those piles there, those pillars there, you got, what's that footing all about there?
Oh, those are some of the new foundations.
That's what you're building. That's all new stuff.
Well, another trade did that work. We created the vertical wall so they could get in there and do that
work. And do that work. Okay.
Yep.
And that's still supporting everything else above.
That's what's there now.
Okay. All right.
And here we are testing one of our anchors. That's a hydraulic jack.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the reflective strips show up on the camera fairly brightly.
Someone used the flash.
Yeah. It was actually pretty dark in there.
How do you, I can imagine, how do you test the anchor? Like, how what do you?
Well, that jack is a hydraulic jack, and it's hollow in the middle. It slides over the steel strands that you see painted orange.
Yep.
They're like cables, would be a layman. In our industry, we call them strands, but they're about 5/8 inch diameter, and we had sort of 2 and 3 strands would create an anchor, and a gripper plate at the end of the jack locks those strands in, and then we pump up the pressure and it pulls out, and then we get readings and we can test the ability of the anchor to hold the load we've designed it for.
Got it. Okay.
And by putting that load in advance, we limit the, because all these vertical walls will tend to want to move inward, and we want to limit that to a manageable amount, say in the order of 5 to 10 millimeters.
Will they still move with the anchors in them?
Sometimes.
Sometimes, right?
Actually, we had a problem here because of the soft ground. We sometimes move some of the walls backwards because they just wasn't... ground wasn't strong enough to resist the anchor load we designed for.
This would have been some of the new fill in the back?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Keep going.
Movement. And all right, there we go. We were just talking about movement.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's an example of a output from the company doing the monitoring.
So how much are we talking about there?
You look at the scale at the bottom.
Okay.
And that's in millimeters. So this actually only moved...
what is that?
About 3 millimeters.
Three, okay, yeah, that's right. Barely, yeah, just over 2. Okay.
Yep, okay.
That was because of those anchors.
Yeah.
That's why.
Well, right. No, what happens is before the anchor goes in, the wall moves in a little bit, and then you put the anchor and you pull it back, but then you get a bit of a belly in it.
Got it. Okay.
Okay.
So challenges, lots of challenges.
Slow pace, and I was telling you about the tight working space and about removing the bulk soil.
Yeah.
And the multiple work areas,
yeah.
And developing design details in the field, adapting the equipment. The shop we had at the time did a fabulous job of basically customizing the equipment to execute this work.
Who was the construction company?
The firm that did the actual, that was my employer, Geo Foundations Contractors.
Okay. All
right. They are now part of Keller Foundations, which is all over the world. So they were acquired by the parent company, by one of these subsidiaries of Keller in 2013.
Okay.
So when I went to work there in 2010, we were an independent, little independent guy. This was like one of our first big urban jobs at the time. And we had done a previous, a tricky little bit of work at the Art Gallery of Ontario, much smaller scale than this, but some comparable methodologies. Yes, but this one was just on a bigger scale, that's all. But because we were doing such good work, they just came back to us with more and more work. And they brought in a competitor for some of the work, and then they terminated their contract early, and we got given their work, which is, I guess, a testament to my great crew and the work they did, and the fact that we responded and had good ideas and ways to advance the project and advance schedule.
Should we, like Charles, should we be building more deeper in urban settings?
We are.
Okay, so, should we amplify it? Like, should we be looking at the possibilities of what we can do? All it really means is escalators and lifts going up and down to certain areas, right?
Going underground has been the way to go. And particularly in the residential condo market where, people still want parking spaces.
Yeah.
And now the city's rules have been relaxed somewhat on how many parking spaces per unit, but you're still looking at a 30, 40-story condo is going to need 4 to 6 underground levels.
I thought it was like a 1.5 ratio to each unit.
You can get concessions on that, depending on where you're located. For example, I have a client with a very narrow site near Yonge and Bloor, and they're using elevators to lift the cars instead of ramps. And it's a European stacked parking system, they call it.
Which works.
And they're able to get away with a much lower ratio because Yonge and Bloor has got such good transit access that not everyone needs a car.
Yeah.
So there is a trend to that, too, with people living downtown, is they don't need a car.
No, they don't.
It caught the average, at the time I was active in the market, a condo parking space was an add-on to the price of the condo, and it was on the order of $35,000.
Yeah, it still is.
And it's more now.
Yeah, it's insane now.
It's $50,000 to $60,000 of parking space now.
But and also, it's factoring in you need that space because you have visitors coming. If you want parents coming or friends coming over, like street parking is not really the way to go when they're trying to eliminate all these lanes for bike lanes. So you need this. And that's why I just keep on thinking, even in residential, we should be going. I mean, when it gets to more of the custom, more expensive, middle to really ultra high end class homes, you're getting people putting their parking garages under their house. You're getting people putting the golf simulators, the basketball courts and things, you know what I mean? And there's no restrictions on going down, right?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that because when I worked in the United States for 3 years in the Mid-Atlantic region and lived in Northern Virginia. And one of the projects that came across my desk was a new home for the then owner of the Washington football team. He's no longer the owner. This guy turned out to be quite a loose cannon, but he had this elaborate residence planned on the banks of the Potomac River with an underground bowling alley and theater. And he was going down probably 6-7 meters. That's unheard of for a house.
For a house, huh?
Quite the undertaking. The
amount of concrete that's going on. Well, excavation.
Well, you got to have money for that.
No, of course.
Okay. Anyway, so we can probably... So these are some of the acknowledgements, the people that worked on the job, Carillion Canada, and there's our Canadian distress signal.
I love that slide when I saw it. I know. I love the effort of someone actually going through the snow like that and making that effort to make it look great.
I usually use that slide in almost all of my presentations.
Because you'll need it at the end of this job, which is great.
Oh, yeah, there was going to be a need for some of that. Actually, I just found out about a month and a half ago, my middle son works as an aircraft tech out of Saint-Hubert Airport in Longueuil, Quebec, across the river from Montreal. And his employer services planes that do a lot of these Arctic runs. And he went to Tony. They had just dropped off the fellow from Geo Foundations that was superintendent on this project up at Mary Lake on Baffin Island for a project they're doing up there.
Where's Baffin Island?
Baffin Island, that's way north.
Wow.
Way north. Calueet is the little village there.
What kind of project that they're doing there?
Mine.
Oh.
Mine. Iron ore mine.
Well, I just figure that Canada is such a large mass and we've got a lot of minerals inside this earth, right?
So a lot of it's in remote areas.
Yeah, but let's start mining it, right? Let's start getting it and using it and selling it.
Well, the problem with mining industry in Canada is that we're competing with lower wage countries without advanced health and safety requirements and things like that. We have a lot more uphill battle here in Canada to make mines viable, but where the deposits are rich and concentrated, it is still viable.
Yeah. All right. So has this project now, are they inviting you back to continue it? Because I'm assuming it's ongoing.
No, I'm not no longer affiliated with that firm. So okay. I'm retired from them now and on freelance now.
Okay.
Still have a relationship with the people there. Actually, I'm working with them on a private school project in Toronto right now, where some of the people I worked with back then are out there constructing micropiles to provide an addition for a high-end private school in the Don Mills area.
So how was it back then, Charles, when you got started like four decades ago and you're surveying, did you start in the commercial or you started in the residential sector?
My first summer surveying, we were doing land surveys for residential subdivisions.
Okay.
But the next summer I worked for a large mechanical contractor and built a building a steel plant in Hamilton. And I was serving in heavy machinery. The summer after that, I ended up working, actually the next two summers I worked out at the then Steel Company of Canada Lake Erie Works on the North Shore of Lake Erie just east of Port Dover. Spent 16 months out there basically surveying, doing layout, pipe racks, blast furnace, ore handling dock. So I got quite a exposure to construction back then. And I wasn't undecided what I was going to do. I was still in engineering school. I didn't even know what kind of engineer I was going to end up being. And one of the firms that was working out there doing foundations for the blast furnace contracted with my employer. They needed to rent a surveyor, and I went to work for them. And after about a week, the foreman came to me and said, well, what are they paying you? And I told him, and he says, tell them I'm laying you off. I don't need you. And you come back next week and work for cash, four times what you're making. And he says, next summer, if you need a job, go and see this guy. So I went and the next summer, got a summer job with them. And then they offered me a full-time position at my graduation year.
Once you graduated.
Right? Yep. Yeah. I joined them in 1979. I was there until 2002.
And how's, I guess, the education now for engineers? So has it improved or is it very similar?
Well, we have computers now, and that helps quite a bit. Things have advanced. We do a lot more, the study of the below ground stuff and what we call the geotechnical or geostructural engineering, that's not as sought after by some young engineers as something more exotic like structural steel or building the high rise above grade or doing a tunnel. So it's hard to attract people go into this field of study, and it's advancing, but it's advancing at a slower pace than some of the innovations and other methods like the advanced building materials that we're seeing now for above ground. So not as much attention gets paid to the below ground, even though it's a vital component of a project.
Yeah, like I was mentioning earlier, like we have so much space down there that we should be looking at options, and someone should be, a lot of this younger generation should be considering how we can do some interesting things.
Well, we're working on it. We're trying to get there. There's some pretty good research being done at the Canadian universities. It's driven a lot, not so much by the urban requirements here, but by our harsh climate, things like permafrost, and Canada is very dependent on infrastructure because we're so spread out.
Yeah.
And someone once said at the turn of the century, Canada has too much geography and not enough history.
It's a good phrase. It's a great phrase, actually. Mm-hmm. It's so, very true.
Anyways,
I mean, I'd love to hear from you about certain projects that were challenging to you, I guess, when you got on site conditions and discovering things that may not have been there at that time.
There's always challenges, of course. Sometimes you'll find that whoever... Most projects start with drill boreholes to investigate soil and rock conditions, and we have to rely on that and study that and examine that, and use our own experience and knowledge, and within the the midtown downtown Toronto area, I've probably done a project every couple of blocks, so I know without even looking at a borehole what we're likely to find. The waterfront lands are a bit more of a challenge because, again, it was reclaimed land, but we've done quite a lot of work on the waterfront now, so that's no longer such a challenge. I'm more in awe of the older infrastructure when they did had very primitive equipment, how they actually got things built. Nowadays we have big cranes and big excavators and some very expensive equipment back in those early days. And I'm thinking even as early as the late 60s, early 70s, things were pretty primitive in this industry. It's advanced considerably since then.
I was just thinking, like, how would the CN Tower have been built today if they got started it today compared to how it was built back in the 70s? Mm-hmm.
They probably would have used a similar technique.
Yeah.
It's founded on the bedrock, of course, because it was done by continuous slip forming. I don't know if you knew that, but they never stopped pouring concrete. The forms would get dialed in to create that shape that you see, and it kept on going and going and going and going. That was an amazing accomplishment at the time.
So long ago, and they pulled it off that way, and then it was just the highest structure in the world at the time.
Tallest freestanding structure in the world at the time.
Oh, that's insane.
So now,
the beauty of concrete. There is a lot of beauty in the concrete. Well, I know that when Martin was here, he had such a bone to pick with the gardener and how it's a constant Band-Aid. It's like it's just constantly being. And right now, as we're recording, it's down to two lanes on the bulk of it.
I've been reading. I'm avoiding Toronto. Yeah,
I have no interest to be anywhere near it because of that. And a lot of people are seeing it, and they have to unfortunately go to work. They have to go to job sites. They have to. Mm-hmm. A lot of that structures, those high rises, those condos are all being built right there. So you've got a workforce that has to drive that route.
Yeah, that's the sad reality of it. And I even think of crawling on the QEW today. A nice bright day, good weather, favorable conditions, and yet why is it bumper to bumper at 1 o'clock in the afternoon?
And you have a solution?
It's just, we have a mature population market where we have equal movement in both directions at peak hours.
That makes no sense to me, because when I was younger,
it was rush hour in and rush hour out.
Exactly.
It's what they call a matured traffic pattern now, where it's equally busy in both directions.
What's
all the time.
The solution? More roadways? That's not the solution. I've seen the studies on that.
Sometimes roadways are essential, but I think the number one problem we have to really deal with is timing of truck traffic with commuter traffic and putting some restrictions on that. The trucking industry is going to holler, but that's about the only way I can see to...
I've been saying that there should be certain roadways that are designated for trucks and only for trucks.
They do have that in New York City.
Yeah, but they don't have it here.
No.
They need it here.
New York City, believe it or not, I've driven... enough in New York City to know it's much easier to navigate that huge metropolis than it is to navigate Toronto.
It's a grid system.
And there's very good transit.
Yep.
And they have what they call parkways and expressways. Parkways are for cars only, expressways are for whatever.
Yeah.
And even they say the Brooklyn Queens Expressway or the Verrazano Bridge, it doesn't get backlogged like we see here.
But a lot of it, in all fairness, a lot of it is... was built at a time when the budgets and the rates for the workers that were working on these things was reasonable and possible versus now. I mean, I've always said it, that our subway was 40 years late compared to New York and Chicago. Oh,
we stopped building subway.
Yeah, we just stopped. And then it made no sense. I don't understand.
When we decided to start again, we had sticker shock at how much more expensive it was.
It's challenging to start coring and going and digging and getting all that stuff in there.
Well, sadly, there's now a trend to basically design these underground stations like Cold War bunkers. I'm looking at the design of the 1950s and 60s era, the original Yonge subway, and looking at some of the things we're building now for some of these newer projects, and the amount of extra wall thickness you're calling for and roof thickness is just, it staggers me, and I don't see the need for it. And that's another topic near and dear to my heart, maybe not relevant here, but...
No, it's completely relevant. It's because Martin brought it up too, and I questioned it, and he just said that to challenge it takes longer to actually start the project. So you might as well just go that route.
We've got a bunch of embedded... people in positions of in decision-making positions that aren't going to be shaken. If I could have an hour meeting with Doug Ford and explain to him the waste from the provincial agencies constructing our infrastructure, he would probably be amazed.
And question is, would he do anything about it?
I think he might.
Okay.
And I'm at the stage of my career where I don't really care who I annoy anymore.
I love getting older for that reason. Yeah. I know. It's amazing.
That's one of the benefits of it, eh? It's a best.
So what are some things that you would look at doing? I'm curious.
Well, a lot of what drives the cost is delays in turning around documents and allowing people to get on with their work and putting silly restrictions on them that aren't really necessary and have no engineering merit, just because someone wrote it down in a book.
We see that filter right down to residential. That happens all the time.
Residential is a little bit more forgiving that way, the private sector work, they're more likely to listen to a reasonable option or alternative.
Is it a liability thing? Nobody wants to take the responsibility if something fails?
It's part of it, and it's just that rather than try and be a bit more innovative in your design and try and save money, there's no motivation on the engineering firms that are doing designs to save money. They get no acknowledgement of saving money. So why would they?
Well, because it actually makes a city grow if you save money on this project.
I know. We
it's
could
just common sense.
15% more bang for our buck if we could just remove some of these built-in inefficiencies that exist right now in the system, and things would get built faster and for less money, and they have money left over to do more, basically.
I've always said I need more workwear and less suits.
Yeah.
Basically it, right? Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Because we know what we're talking about, and the mm-hmm. workforce that builds these things, they yep. know what needs to be done, right? But we get it. It's like politicians, legalities, you got concerns or whatever. Then there's, I don't think the question of disrupting the pedestrian public or traffic flows, that's not even an issue in Toronto anymore. They just do it. They'll just sign off and the construction will start and everyone's just going to have to accept the increase in congestion.
So you can't even get cooperation between different agencies of the same government. And that I think is wrong. And that's something that can be fixed.
Yeah.
Give you an example. We have a rail expansion project to improve the service on from Union Station to Barrie commuter rail. Project's been stalled for a year due to the Ministry of the Environment. The station that we need that needs some work on this line is in the midst of a wetland, but they knew that. And it's been dragged on and dragged on to get the approvals.
Approvals from where?
Because we're going to have to temporarily fill in part of the wetland to do the construction
and then restore it. Okay.
And these agencies just, there's no incentive for them to be cooperative and be efficient and work together. That's the problem, not working together. Everyone has their own little empire. And
like Charles, I have always had this mindset whenever I go to a government organization or building and just watch the employees. They are paid a set amount of money per hour, per day, whatever it is. If they service 10 people or if they service 20 people, it's still the same amount of money. Mm-hmm. So they're not motivated to service more people than they know that they can achieve in one day.
I think it's maybe a bit unfair. I'm sure there's some extremely hardworking, dedicated people out there doing good work.
For the government?
Mm-hmm. But I think like the just like I described this cooperation between different agencies. And another example is you've been hearing all the delays on the completion of the Eglinton Crosstown Light Rail.
The LRT.
I worked quite a bit on that from 2015 until just a few years back on some of the stations.
So what's going on with that one?
A part of constructing the. These new stations, they're basically dug from the top down, what they call a cut and cover.
Okay.
So we have to do shoring around the perimeter and then put a steel bridge, literally a bridge mounted on the shoring to put the traffic back on. But all this involves having to relocate utilities that exist in the roadway. And we have public and private utility owners, and nobody would cooperate and expedite their relocations and did it on their own schedule, that held the job. Every station got held up by at least a year waiting for because of lack of cooperation from all the different public and private utilities. And that's
how long has that project been in the works? Like when did they first call it out in the media saying we're going to do this, we're going to start work on this?
Well, the the tunnels contract was actually started in, I would say, it might have been put out on the market in maybe 2011, 2012. The tunnels themselves were more or less complete by 2015. But the station's contract, which is the one that's the big controversy, that happened after the, so there was a different company that did all the tunnels. They were already there waiting. We basically put in, excavated the stations, exposed the tunnel, busted out the part that was in the station and built the station. And that work started, the first station was at Kiel and Eglinton, and that started, they started installing the piles in 2015, late 2015.
10 years ago.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that station was, it's been capable of being in service for at least 5 years now. It was done.
So
it was,
it's just
it
a went, ghost town right now.
Well, because the other stations down the line, they're just now wrapping up, for example, yeah, so Young you Eglinton can. Station and some yeah. of the others. But they did open up the Kiel station to do the testing. All right. So I was able actually to get down in there and take a walk in the tunnels, which is pretty interesting.
How they look?
Very nice.
They're very yeah. nice, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So the tunneling technology was much better than when they did the original Young subway, for example. That's advanced, but everything costs more now. And then we're designing the some of the existing subway stations, which are still in service and still fine. They, for example, the walls would be 2.5 feet thick, 30 inches. So now we're building these stations with walls that are 6 feet thick. Why? And no,
I don't get it.
No,
and costs more, takes longer, mm-hmm. have to reroute more utilities. Because, yeah.
Well, the carbon footprint of producing all that extra concrete and all that extra steel and what it costs, the dollars, everything.
I don't even think it's a carbon green argument anymore. Like, the moment you start construction, it's construction. That's how it is. You're doing it to alleviate the congestion in a city. You're doing it so you mm-hmm. can actually move a city. Yep. That's what's really key here. That's what's really important.
Yeah, and at least... The current regime is promoting that and doing that, which is quite encouraging, and it's actually provided me with a living. So I'm in favor of the infrastructure. I think it could be done a bit more efficiently, but let's just keep charging ahead on that.
But whenever I see the Gardiner being knocked down and it's getting receded away from the east end of the city, mm-hmm. I start questioning how are we supposed to move all this traffic when you have plenty of people coming from the west going to the east. Like, I don't understand.
At the time it was built, it was a great idea, but other cities with downtown elevated highways have been tearing them down and putting everything underground. So Seattle is doing that with their Alaskan Way Viaduct. Boston did it, of course, with the John Fitzgerald Expressway and the Big Dig.
Yeah, which actually worked.
And there was a lot of complaints about the Big Dig, but you know what? It turned out beautifully, and now what they have is a nice linear park along the footprint of that former elevated ugly expressway. I was lucky enough to attend a conference in Boston at the height of the activity there, so I was able to get around to see some of the work that was being done.
I remember when that was happening, yeah.
Yep. So I've been lucky to go to enough conferences to see enough things to get a bit more of a broader view than just our little zone
here.
So
what's the solution here in Toronto? If you eliminate the Gardiner, so we've got one elevated deck here, that's one outside, I guess, of the DVP, right? Parts of it are elevated, but... what's the solution now? How do you move that traffic then?
There was talk of routing it out in the harbor underground at one time.
And smart.
It was going to be several. At the time, this was talked about maybe 15 or more years
totally
ago.
Totally do a tunnel and, through the harbor.
And the price tag was $2 or $3 billion. Now that price tag would be 10 or 12 billion, maybe more.
So why don't we just get politicians to just get a pay cut, all of them? Mm-hmm. And then take all that extra money and then build this new Gardiner underneath the harbor. And lots of traffic would be moving from east to west, west to east. Like,
or even put it underground on its existing footprint like they did in Boston. Like, it's underground my now. Concern it follows the exact route, just underground.
My concern with that is you're going to get all the people that live just south of the Gardiner and possibly even some of the islanders complaining. I don't know why, but they'll just complain, right?
In fact, if it was underground, it would actually be more aesthetically pleasing to the people that have places along the side of the Gardiner.
Yeah.
So I would think that would make people happier.
Could you make like a transparent tunnel underneath the harbor so you can actually see all the crap that's inside our lake there?
Yeah. Well, they would go well down into the rock. Like the new Ontario line that you've been reading about that's going to pass through downtown Toronto, that's going well down in the rock. It's going well underneath the original Yonge and University lines.
Wow.
Quite deep, as a matter of fact.
When are they starting that?
They're already underway with the vertical drilling for some of the stations. So there's work going on at Queen and Spadina and at King and Bathurst, at Queen and Sherbourne. Very soon to start at Front End Parliament. These are like four of the stations. There are going to be six stations in downtown Toronto on this Ontario line. Corktown, which is in the Distillery District.
Yep.
Moss Park, which is Yonge and Sherbourne.
Yep.
Of course, Yonge, Queen and Yonge. And then Osgoode Station at University and Yonge. And then Spadina, Queen, King Bathurst. And then at the west end, the line is going to emerge through a portal above ground at Exhibition Stadium, right, Exhibition Station. And on the east end, it's going to exit just at the Don River, and then going to be an elevated bridge over the Don River, and it's going to go on surface from basically the East Harbor area up to Girard and Pape, and then it's going to dive underground, run north underneath Pape Avenue, and then daylight out into the Don Valley in a portal, and then go on an elevated guideway over the Don Valley, right through Thorncliffe Park, turn a 90 and go up to the Science Center, and that's the terminus of the line.
So you're basically going to hit everywhere then. You're going to be able to act. So you'll get from the Portlands, and you can go north, and you can go also west.
This line has been talked about for years. The other thing is it takes traffic that's coming in from the east on the existing Bloor-Danforth line and diverts it downtown so that the Yonge and Bloor station, which is highly, highly congested, gets some relief, at least for traffic coming from the east. So that's going to be a big bonus.
And what's the number on that?
The Ontario line? I can't say, but it's billions.
It's billions, right? And what's the predicted completion date, and then what's the realistic completion date?
Basically going at the pace at which they're now letting contracts now for packages of the work. It's carved up into different packages. I'm going to say we're talking 2028, 2029 maybe.
That fast? Really? Mm-hmm.
As I said, we're already underway with some of the stations, and the tunneling is going to go fairly well because it's all rock tunneling, and that's relatively foolproof, not many surprises.
See, this is a concern about this city, that if we don't start doing projects like that and making more projects like that, you can't invite the world to come to this city to either, you know, be a tourist in it or consider economically doing something in this city or this country, right? Like you start seeing, I saw a stat today that it was talking about how much business and economy has left Canada in the last 8 years. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like actually they haven't seen this many exodus since 2014.
We should be attracting more people. Traffic congestion and the ease of moving around is all part of that quality of life number. And you see all these rankings of best cities in the world, blah. That's one of the big considerations in developing that kind of a rating, and I think we're not doing very well in that regard.
I'm just curious because I know a lot of tradespeople do this, and I can only assume engineers and architects do it as well. When you're traveling and you're going around the world and you see a job site, I'm assuming that you stop and you take a peek, right? We all do it. Are there any interesting structures that you got a peek at, you know, that just things that caught your eye that you're like, okay, that's pretty interesting. That's pretty cool the way they were doing it, how it was built.
Well, one that was really sobering was to visit the site of the Twin Towers and look at the memorial they've built there. That was really, really a moving thing to see that, and to see the new Freedom Tower going up and to see still the paint blistering on the buildings around that area that were close to the heat but not damaged themselves.
Yeah.
Just amazing. And I don't know if you ever read the accounts of that the Twin Towers and the sort of at grade podium in the underground were built on with a concrete bathtub that was constructed.
Yeah,
it was a concrete diaphragm wall, and again, that's one another technique in our industry. And actually, I had the good fortune to meet the gentleman whose firm actually did that original work back in the 70s.
Early 70s, yeah.
Yes, it was a firm called Treviecos. They were out of the Italian parent company. And this gentleman, he passed away a number of years ago, but I was actually able to get him to come to speak in at our one of our events in Toronto on the Big Dig, because they were a big player in the Big Dig as well as in the World Trade Center bathtub. So... And one of the concerns they had, of course, was when the buildings collapsed and the underground floors within the what was the parking garage and underground garage, they had to do temporary anchors to brace it. Otherwise, the pressure of the groundwater and soil would have basically collapsed these diaphragm walls. So they were luckily we were able to get in there on an emergency basis and stabilize those walls until they could rebuild the internal structures to brace those walls.
Because that's where the two fountains are right now.
Correct, correct.
So they, were they using that to...
The actual bathtub was the whole block. The towers were right in the middle. They were just in the middle of the block.
Oh, it was wow. I didn't realize they went that big.
And trains, commuter rails coming, going through there, subway going through there. It was a huge transit terminal below the World Trade Center that was in all underground. And now they were able to restore quite a lot of that. They had some service interruptions for a while they did this work, but... They actually took that as an opportunity to make some major improvements.
I know there's been a lot of talk on social media where I've seen certain people suggest that extending Manhattan and creating new fill past that point. Have you seen any like?
I have not. There's filling in the water is not a very popular topic and a very hard one to sell to a lot of people. We used to do it, of course, to create land, and that's how a lot of the current harbor line of Toronto was built, but you wouldn't get permission to do that now.
Not in Toronto.
No. And in fact, actually, we're digging up some of that. I don't know if you've read about the reconstruction of the mouth of the Don River.
Yeah.
So back when they built the eastern portlands, the Don River was channeled into a sharp 90-degree turn and coming out into the harbor.
Yep.
And, of course, then it would always flood and silt.
Yep.
So they've now created a direct path for the Don River to exit out to the lake so that you don't have these problems anymore. So it's improving the quality of the Don River itself as well.
It's pretty impressive. I saw some of the animations on that project, how it's coming along, and it's moving along nicely.
Yep.
It's going to be quite, it's almost like another city is being built right inside the city.
That's right.
In that one little area. But I was mostly fascinated by the idea of that water, how they split into three. They don't do that sharp turn anymore. Now it's three gentle turns, and it moves water a lot better.
Much better.
Yeah.
And they're creating some parkland as well.
Yeah.
And there's going to be residential parkland and some, maybe some live work kind of developments.
Yep.
You're seeing a lot of studio type things now. You're seeing a lot of that being done. That's pretty exciting what they've done there.
So it's interesting times in Toronto.
There's plenty going on. That's for sure. It's the residential market is very tight right now because of the interest rates, but the infrastructure is just forging ahead.
Still moving. They're preparing for a bunch of people coming into the city, working in the city, using the city. I'm just trying to think of what other parts of the city. I mean, One Bloor West is still going along now after that fiasco.
That's unfortunate what went on there. I was involved very early on in that project when the shoring was being installed. I was on site a couple of times. And
how deep do they go on that one?
Because
that's going to be the
tallest building in
Toronto.
In Toronto, yeah.
Yeah.
It's called The One.
Yep.
And unfortunately, the original team that was managing the job when it started, they were quite good. They did nothing wrong. They just got, when the ownership started fighting with each other, they each wanted their own guy. And those guys, unfortunately, got removed from the project through no fault of their own.
Okay.
And, but they got the hole down, basically. And that was quite the undertaking. I don't know if we'll see another one like that. I see things being announced that are going higher and higher and higher, but I don't know. Everything's sitting right now.
What's the concern when you go higher? You have to go deeper and you have to just build?
No, better foundations. No, we can, we've got the technology and the methodologies and the experience and the knowledge to construct tall buildings in this. We've got reasonably favorable on below grade conditions for tall buildings.
Okay.
Some cities in the world have challenges with that because they may have hundreds of feet of very soft soils, and that becomes Japan. You hear about problems with
earthquakes,
seismic events causing. Yeah. That's because a lot of the coastal areas of Japan are very soft clay deposits, and they liquefy during a seismic event, and then so actually it's made the Japanese develop some pretty good techniques of their own for mitigating this, and some of that's made its way over to North America.
Well, it's movement, isn't it? Like the structure is designed as if it's...
The effect of a seismic event is what happens is, imagine two rough pieces of rock and you start pushing one against the other and they start jumping and shaking. That is an earthquake. That's what it is.
Yep.
And it's basically, it takes, it'll take a tall building like this.
Okay.
And it's like down at the base, it just gets whipped. It whips. Literally, that's what the seismic event does.
Okay.
And that creates uplift on part of the building and bending in the building and things like that. So, but the codes we have now take all that into account. Back when some of these buildings were built, there really was very little in the way of seismic code requirements. So that's a big thing.
But Toronto doesn't have any seismic issues.
We are one of the... In the one of the lowest frequency zones. Like, the country's divided into seismic zones.
Yeah.
You can see it in the building code. And ironically, Hamilton, just down the road, is one seismic zone worse than Toronto. So Toronto is in one of the more what's considered one of the more benign conditions for seismic risk.
Okay, I didn't know that. All right.
Yeah, and of course, countries like Japan are at the and have a very high rating, high frequency or high risk zone.
I know there's a lot more risk out west in BC,
yes. Yep.
Right? So you're dealing with the rock there. And
yeah, you do have that issue in the lower mainland of BC as well.
So how is it that, like, Dubai gets away with building all kinds of land and they're dealing with sand and soft? And I know that I remember looking at some of the data regarding the Burj Khalifa where I can't remember how many piles were put in before they actually started the foundation. They had to go so deep.
They would just be driving piles.
Yeah, just constantly going, right?
Sand is very conducive for that kind of a foundation, which is a fairly economical foundation and fairly quick to construct. So, and one of the problems we have now is that they don't like pile driving in Toronto anymore. And
reason?
The reason is that pile driving creates noise and vibration, and so people don't like that. So the city of Toronto enacted a vibration bylaw that basically precludes the use of any conventional pile driving equipment within the city of Toronto.
I remember back in my day, back in the 90s, I used to be at an office down at Spadina, King and Spadina.
Uh-huh.
And there was a parking lot there, and all of a sudden the parking lot disappeared, as they do in Toronto.
Yeah.
And then the piles came in, right?
Yep.
And it was every day for probably 3 or 4 months, just hammering, yep. Hammering.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, but... there's a structure there now, and you have to put all that stuff in there. Yep. You have to start. That's how the project starts.
The ancient Romans drove timber into the ground to create piling for their buildings.
Yeah.
With very primitive equipment, tripods and, you know, hooking up using work animals and slaves and whatever to do all of this. So we're a little further ahead in the way we do
it. Well, it's kind of unfair for the population that lives in the core to complain about the noise. Mm-hmm. In the core, right? When there's lots of core noise, all kinds of core noise. Even if you're living in an apartment or someplace that's on the streetcar line and you're hitting it, like, you'll hear that streetcar, it will rattle your structure. That just happens. That's part of the core.
I lived in Midtown Toronto for 3 years in an apartment building, and there was noise all night.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
It's like background noise.
Yeah.
It wasn't like awful, but it was always there. It was never like truly quiet. So
what if they gave the pile drivers like a rhythm? You know what I mean? So it wasn't just like dum dum.
There are things like shrouds that can muffle noise.
Really?
Yeah, but it kills the production. It's much slower to install a pile. Yeah, it costs more.
That's so what I figured.
Everything comes with a price.
Any thoughts on what's going on with that project, The Line, out there in Dubai there?
In Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Yeah. I see pictures from time to time. Don't quite understand exactly what it is that they're doing there. And
I'm just trying to think of like the structural components, like the engineering attached to it, not even just the foundation itself, but just to have these two vertical elements that are solid glass, mirror, whatever it's going to be, and the opposing forces on it for such a long distance.
Yeah, I just don't, I'll have to see it advance before I can really
talk about fully rattling, grasp, like grasp talk about what's vibration, going on. Talk yeah. about like,
I don't know what like, things like, so the things that are the enemy of a tall structure, tall slender structure, of course, seismic, like we talked about, and wind.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm not sure what the prevailing wind conditions are like in that part of the world. And
sandstorms.
Sure. Yeah, sandstorms, yep. So,
even some of the billionaires roll in New York around Central Park there, when you see those really tall structures that they built there, and they've got those pass-through. So they've actually taken out certain floors and just let the wind go right through it because it's such a narrow, tall building that it would sway so much more if they didn't do that.
Well, there's now techniques where you put actually build dampers into the building to lessen the effects of these unbalanced.
It goes back to that. There's the water balancing at the top of structures, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. I think
that's one way of damping.
Okay, all right.
And others just put giant shock absorbers in sort of maybe mid height in the structure, have a whole floor basically like a giant shock absorber.
How would you, can you shrink it down? If I were to build something that was only 10 feet tall, how big would that shock absorber or that water tank be, like to compare it for it to prevent it from countering? I'm trying to figure out how, because I've seen some of them when mm-hmm. I've checked it out. I've never physically seen it. I've seen it in videos and images.
I think you really only need to worry about that when your structures become super tall, and that's in the order of these 50 to even at 50 stories, that's not unmanageable.
Yeah.
First Canadian Place, which was built in the 1970s, was 75 stories, and that time was the tallest building in Canada.
Yeah.
But getting beyond that now, which is where we're going, this starts to become something you need to look at, consider. Of course, the science of this kind of tall building engineering has advanced considerably since then. At one time, you couldn't make concrete work for a building taller than about 20 stories, 30 stories, and now everything had to be structural steel skeleton back then, and now they're doing really tall buildings without structural steel.
Is there a limit?
Apparently not now.
Apparently that you can keep on going higher and higher still.
They're getting more and more advanced with how they design these.
So I guess, it's just like how you said, it's like once you design it as that tall, you have to figure out how you get that material up there.
Oh.
Specifically concrete, but then the forming.
Massive pumps. It's massive concrete pumps.
Like, are you pumping to one level and then pumping to another level?
There's probably boosters and everything.
Yeah, that's what I'm assuming. Some of
the tall buildings.
Okay.
In the old days, it was just you had a tower crane. You've seen what a tower crane is.
Yeah.
Concrete trucks down the street, bucket lands, fill the bucket, hoist it up in the air to the guys ready to pour. But now you get sophisticated internal piping and pumping, and you just deliver the concrete to where it needs to go. That's saves on that old bucket method. They still use the tower cranes for hoisting materials, concrete placement, which can take up. See, the crane is needed by everybody, and it's a fight to get crane time, as they say on a site. Any high rise site, it's a fight for crane time. And if you can take away the need for crane time by having a different way to get your concrete, then that frees up your crane for doing other things and maybe improving the overall schedule of the building.
How's the innovation on concrete these days?
Quite advanced in terms of the additives to allow you to do this kind of vertical transportation.
Yeah.
and retarding the set, and also some of the concrete strengths. We're in these tall buildings now. We're getting some quite high stresses in concrete at the lower levels. So at one time, you brought me back using PSI, which is what I learned when I was beginning in the business. But the 20 megapascal concrete is about 3200 PSI.
Okay.
And that's the minimum structural grade concrete you'll see. But we're now seeing mixes 60, 70, 80 MPA.
That high, so
in other words, like,
you know, what's the reasoning for that? Because of
the stresses, the
compression,
taller buildings on concrete, okay,
yeah,
and the weight of all those floors above. And we're getting very fancy now with things like those curved buildings you see out in Mississauga's condos, like
yeah,
designing that and how we transfer the loads when there's nothing below it. That's
Is that just a different technique of cantilevering?
Yeah.
Like, that's all,
yeah, they're
is,
just
right?
cantilevering and then just stepping out.
And then
out.
There's still, I mean, can we dumb it down to like it's still like a 2-to-1 kind of ratio as long as you're just moving, and you're not exceeding that cantilever?
Well, they'll run a fancy model,
yeah,
and tell you exactly how it's going to perform.
Because I just figure that what I like seeing is structures going up that you haven't seen before, and all of a sudden you see that be completed, and now you get somebody else that's going to design something that's even going to be a more of a challenge going on that. I like seeing that, but I don't see it all that happening. For the most part, a lot of the Toronto structures that are going up, they're not photogenic.
No.
For lack of a better word.
Again, the developer has a budget for his engineering team.
Yeah.
And if they want to get something more elaborate, creative, that engineering number is going to have to go up. And he's going to have to find, you know, cut somewhere else, say, or make his building more expensive. So it's a balancing act. Some, a high-end building, they will do things like that, and they'll say they can sell at any price, so it doesn't matter. But
are you guys always debating with the architects and the designers about ideas that you wanna or they wanna implement, and then you're looking at how you engineer this and how do you put it together?
Well, remember, I'm wearing my contractor's hat, and most of my career has been actually on the contracting side. The actual engineering team worked for the owner or for the general contractor or construction manager, but we interacted with them, and the good ones would listen to the contractors and buy into some of the things we proposed, and others would just nope. And part of the problem would be that they've already used up their budget, so if they have to go back and make changes, they can't get paid more money, so why would they say okay?
Yeah,
even if it saved the project more money and time, no incentive. It's a sad fact of life.
So the Chrysler building back to New York, the Eagles on the Chrysler building, it was a Chrysler building. Mm-hmm. I saw a video recently where they were just putting those Eagles on, the heads there, right? Mm-hmm. And that wouldn't be happening today. Like, you wouldn't spend the effort to actually do that little detail in each four corners. Oh. And then just the fabrication of that, then the logistics to get it up there, and then the logistics behind anchoring and securing it to the structure. Like, that's something that would just be dismissed right off the drawing.
The level of quality of workmanship back in those times was like night and day compared to now. Not that we don't do good work.
Yeah.
But the idea of doing that nice fine detailing, that's gone. It's a lost skill.
Such a shame.
It is a shame. I don't know if you've ever gone into the some of the renovated theaters in Toronto and seen some of the plaster work in that.
Oh.
Like you wouldn't get that now. No one knows how to do that anymore.
No. It would cost an arm and a leg just to kind of mold it to copy it and then to reproduce it someplace else. I know.
Yeah.
It's such a shame.
And actually, it's interesting. One of my good friends visited Peru and Chile last year, and he visited some of these native villages, and he's shown me some pictures of some dry stone walls, and the joints in the stones are so precise. And these things are thousands of years old, and I'm not sure what kind of tools they would have even had. Now, when we need to carve a nice joint in rock, we have a wire saw, or we have a diamond saw. We can do nice. Those guys had none of that stuff.
No.
And how did they do it? I don't know.
And it's still there today.
Still there today.
Challenging at that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to all the young workers, tradespeople out there that, you know, when they get a chance to work with someone like yourself, how should they be? Their mindset, how should they be on site?
Learn always. Get out to the sites. Ask questions. And just be thirsty to learn more.
Because there's always something to learn, right?
And the other thing you have to remember is you don't have to know every answer or how to solve every problem, but you better learn who to ask.
Yeah.
If you don't know it, know who to ask. That simple.
Because on any job site, there's always someone to ask.
Or you have a colleague to ask.
It's true.
I have a colleague who's in his late 80s now, and I, as a young guy growing up, in the business, his firm did work for my company, and I spent a lot of time with him, and we were collaborating on quite a few nice projects, and he, in his retirement, joined the same client that I now have, and he was spending one day in there mentoring young engineers. This guy, we could go to lunch, and on the back, literally on the back of a napkin, he could design your bridge for you.
Really?
Like, by hand. He just had it.
Wow.
So, like, and that's, we're losing that a little bit, unfortunately, in the newer generation. But, and the other thing I'd say is, once in a while, unplug your computer.
Mm.
And actually, in fact, before you run your computer program, you should have a pretty good idea what the answer ought to be, just by knowledge, experience, and basic understanding. It's almost like a feel you get after you've done it enough times.
Yeah, that's where it is. I mean, you get that on-site vibe. You get that, yeah.
Well, I can look at a set of drawings and get a sense of whether it looks right or not, just without even running any numbers, just giving it a once-over and looking at it, saying, well, how are they going to build this? And that's the other part of the message for the guys on the engineering side is don't design on paper what you have to wish into the ground. Make it so it can be built.
Is there a lot of that going on?
There is a lot of that
going on. A lot of that going on.
Yeah.
That's where I think I had, I forget his name, but from Altera. And I had always a bone to pick, especially in Toronto, how the renderings and the mm-hmm. models and the mocking, you know, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you see the final product, and I'm like, that's not what was kind of sold. I guess mm-hmm. logistically, when you started figuring it out how to build this, you couldn't build it that way. Mm-hmm. But you're right. They start designing these ideas that are not possible.
Yeah. I see designs for bored concrete foundations with reinforcing steel, and the designer has got the bars so close together, the concrete can't even squeeze out. It's just crazy. Hmm. You need to get special fancy mixes, and he could have got away with probably a third of the steel he's got in there, but no one's paying him to save steel, so let's put lots of steel in there. So
we got to do the 12 questions here, Charles. I just want everybody to share. Charles Grands here, Geostructural Project Services. You can reach him on his email at cggrands. At outlook.com, CRANS. You ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
What is your favorite construction word? Or phrase?
Efficient design.
Because it sort of solves two problems. Mm-hmm. Least favorite tool?
Jackhammer.
Useful.
And if I had to use one before, that's why.
Yeah, useful. What do you miss from your childhood?
Watching the old sitcoms on TV in black and white.
What construction sound do you love?
The drill rig's engine turning.
Production, work.
Yep.
Favorite beverage?
Craft beer and or red wine.
Domestic or foreign?
Either.
Either. What turns you on and off in construction?
Again, we've already touched on this. Wasteful design, lack of interaction with the site, and not listening to helpful suggestions.
Yep. What turns you on?
The opposite of that.
Just the opposite of all that.
Cooperation between the different stakeholders on a job.
Yeah.
Where they sit around a table and work things out.
Team effort. Everyone's got to get together, right? Work on it together. That's how we're going to solve it together.
Yep.
Simple as that.
Efficient meetings without too many people.
Yeah. Favorite curse word? If you don't curse, don't worry about it.
Oh, I do.
Oh, okay. Could be in any language.
Oh. Oh, I used to know some good ones in other languages.
Nothing's coming to mind?
Nothing's coming to mind.
Nothing?
They're all good.
Favorite vehicle? Any mode of transportation?
Nice fast boat.
Fiberglass or wood?
One of those classic old wood jobs you see and up in the Muskokas.
Mm-hmm. They're nice to look at.
Oh, yeah.
What profession other than your own would you like to attempt one day?
Artist.
What profession do you not want to do?
Accountant.
Last question. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at those pearly gates?
Can you come over here and take a look at this for me?
I like that one. That's a good one. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Charles. I really appreciate you coming in and making the time.
I'd like to close with one story about construction.
Please.
A little one.
Please.
So a contractor owned a small firm. He won the lottery, $12 million. And he's at the press conference. They're interviewing him saying, what are you going to do? Buy a vacation home? Go around the world? I'm going to stay in construction until the money's all gone.
That's a good way to do it.
Yep.
Live your life. Enjoy what you do.
Yep.
I like that.
But if you think you're going to get rich at it, you got to be very smart and very careful.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. I'm glad that Martin connected us and love to continue. And I'm sure that with Martin and yourself, and he's probably going to, maybe we should do an engineering roundtable and we just dive deep into a bunch of stuff.
That would be a great thought. We have another colleague that would probably like to get involved in that too.
Okay, cool. Very much. We'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Charles.
Thanks.
That's it. We're out of here.